In the simplest form, it's a, in the molecular structure, it's a long chain, a long carbon chain, which is water-soluble on one end and oil-soluble on the other end. Okay? A very simple molecule. It's very similar. It's exactly to what you find in natural soaps. When applied to floating oil, the molecules become arranged at the oil-water interface as the oil is floating on top of the water. And the effect is to pull the slick apart into tiny micron-sized oil droplets. It actually pulls it apart and surrounds it, solubilizes it, if you will. As the tiny droplets spread apart, they don't have a tendency to sink, but instead they generally remain at or very near the water surface. They don't adhere to fish, to birds, to boats, or shorelines. The oil is much more likely in this state to undergo the natural processes of evaporation, photolysis, biodegradation, and so on. Now, there's a wealth of field and laboratory information on the toxicology of dispersants and oil dispersant mixtures, and it covers information for a wide variety of marine organisms. The basic summary of these data are that the toxicity of corexit in its native form is very low. The toxicity of dispersed oil is much lower than crude oil alone because the concentration in the water column are much lower. Dispersants, as you heard just a bit ago, dispersant use in Prince William Sound requires the approval of the resource agencies in charge of making the decision, including EPA, the Coast Guard, and Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Because dispersants reduce the toxicity and stickiness of the spilled oil, they minimize the harm to fish and wildlife, as well as to shorelines and beaches. Although fish may take up dispersed oil in various environmental conditions, they also depurate it, that is, they lose the concentrations relatively fast. So, you can see the circumstances that dictate the use of dispersants are seldom clear-cut, and the choice is necessarily a compromise between the options and conflicting priorities for protecting different resources from pollution effects. So, it's not a clear-cut decision. Now, just to spend a few minutes on the environmental assessment program, updating you what we've done here to date, we've mobilized a two-pronged effort, if you will, focusing first on the chemical fate of the oil slick, the ultimate disposition, and the concentrations of oil as it's found and spreading in the sound. The second program is focused on the biological effects, the environmental and ecological impacts on the biota. The first piece of the program was designed today in concert with the local resource agencies. A boat will be leaving the harbor at first light tomorrow morning to begin collection of water samples in identified transects down through the sound, heading south, southeast, and west, to find and track the exact concentrations of oil in the water system and in sediment. The biological program is underway. The various components are falling into place. We're looking at the ecology from phytoplankton, zooplankton, fish, waterfowl, and marine mammals. We've brought in experts at each of those levels to advise on the design and implementation of the study program for each one of those components. Biologically, we had our first survey of oiled waterfowl today. Alice Bertner spent the afternoon out overflying the most severely impacted areas in the vicinity of Bly Island. The results of her survey indicate that we've not had a severe impact on waterfowl yet. In the area that she surveyed, she was able to find only approximately 20 oiled birds. Tomorrow morning, we will be dispatching a boat to this area to pick up any available waterfowl that have been exposed to oil. A cleaning center is established in town, and we'll be treating those birds appropriately. The remaining experts on the biological program are arriving in the morning, and we've got a study design in place to begin looking at the other environmental components.
Dr. Mandy, before you leave, may I ask two questions of you, please? That both pertain to dispersants. First off, I would like to know, in your best estimation, what volume of the oil that has been let into the vault, into the water column, total volume, do you feel what percent dispersants deal with? What percent of that volume, total volume, will the dispersants affect and have an effect on it?
Jack, that's a real long guess for me. I just can't give you of what I consider to be a very, very accurate estimate at this stage, because for a couple of reasons, we don't know the overall magnitude of the dispersant application program that will ultimately get in place, and the efficacy will be the amount of oil dispersed will be a direct result of the amount of dispersant that we're ultimately able to effectively apply during the program in the next few days. So it's really possible to give you a good number on that at this stage.
Okay. Second one, I'd like to preface with a recognition of Randy McCall's statement that dispersants at this particular time are being utilized only in Zone 1, which in effect is the designated tanker lane with a very small corridor outside of those lanes on either side. My question is, do you have any data indicating the effect of dispersants used over and over again in one designated area?
The result of laboratory and fairly large scale programs in wave tanks. I mean, tanks, large size pools, swimming pool size, and larger test trials of dispersant indicate that it is effective if applied repetitively to the same area, primarily because new oil slick will move into a previously dispersed area. So you can repetitively apply to an area as new pieces of the slick are moving into that area.
And there's enough water action, you feel, then, to take the previous dispersants and its effects out of that call, out of that particular area? Is that your assumption?
We're encouraged by the data that, the environmental data would support that.
Dr. McKay, or anyone else on the panel, comment on
the use of
napalm
in
the burning of the oil?
I'm not entirely sure of the overall steps in the heliotorch operation, but the burning requires corralling a specific packet of oil in a fireproof boom and then igniting that oil within the boom with a heliotorch. And the exact ignition, I'm not sure exactly how that goes. Perhaps someone can help.
Yeah, I think the phrase napalm creates a lot of thoughts in people's minds. It's the igniting mechanism is a jellied fuel, which is ignited and dropped. And of course the jelly helps hold the fuel into a solid, semi-solid mass that would be, that's so you can drop it in a controlled, from a height, drop it into oil. But,
so that's what they're looking at, kind of like the sterno they drop in or something?
Yes, in a way. There's a helitorch here from helicopter torch, torch something.
Would you be getting access to Exxon?
No, I won't be doing it. No, it's not a Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is not doing it. It's a contractor hired by Exxon.
I mean, even though you don't like the word, it is actually, this jelly fuel is napalm.
We're igniting with a laser torch.
There's several different methods, but
we're igniting with a laser gun.
A laser torch?
There's no napalm around here. Mm-hmm. This is a laser torch. A laser gun.
I stand corrected.
Could you take your chart and explain where the point of first contact was with the ship?
We don't know that. We don't know that. We know where it's resting now, and as I went through this morning, the best explanation of the damage pattern is that there were two distinct contacts. And we don't know the location of the first contact. It could have been just immediately prior to the second. But we do know, looking at the damage pattern, that there had to be two distinct contacts. In fact, the vessel was clearly on a different course in both contacts. The first contact, as best we can tell, the vessel was on a southerly heading, and so with southerly motion. And the second contact, the vessel was essentially on a westerly course pointed back toward the vessel separation lane. If you'd like to elaborate, I could ask Mr. Ed McDonald to help us out. Would you like me to do that?
A mile or 2 miles apart?
If the vessel slid 2 miles before the second contact, it would have to be going pretty fast if it was immediately after the first contact.
No, I think what I said was that from the point when the vessel was in its last southerly direction, at that point it was just a beam of the buoy where Mr. McDonald is pointing. From that point to where it came to rest is about 2 miles. I think that's where I said 2 miles, as best I can tell. Somewhere in that point, we believe that there was an initial contact.
So you said the vessel the same rocks twice?
No, it did
strike. There were two separate accidents. It struck two separate rocks.
And what we're doing at this point is speculating, looking at the damage pattern, because there are two very distinctly different damage areas. But maybe I should go over that. The first damaged area is along the starboard side of the vessel at what we call the turn of the bilge. And that's the very bottom outboard corner of the vessel. And Ed is pointing right now to where that is. That is a totally different damage pattern. And it's not explainable by any of the... at least to our knowledge, any of the area where the vessel is currently resting. So there is that damage pattern. There is a second damage pattern, which is essentially down the center of the vessel. And they are two very distinct different damage patterns. And we're surmising that there had to be two events.
Why wasn't the vessel stopped after the first event?
It was still in its turn. It still had headway. The first activity or the first event was a glancing blow down the starboard side. At that point, the vessel had headway. And continued in its turn as best we can surmise and came to rest with the vessel actually having forward motion in a westerly direction back toward the vessel traffic lane. If I could perhaps move your attention all the way to the chart, the last chart, we could explain the damage patterns a little bit better. And the last chart, the first two charts, what you're looking at is a cross section of the vessel, as if you were standing on the aftermost part of the vessel looking forward. On the very last chart, what we have drawn is a picture of the vessel as if you're looking down, but you're already inside. So you see the tank subdivisions. Now, if you look at that, there are two distinct patterns. One is along the starboard side, which obviously started at the forward edge of the vessel, and we see a number of wrinkled plates at the very bottom corner of the vessel, the starboard. It's where the starboard side and the bottom of the vessel come together, what we call turn of the bilge. And as you proceed further down, what actually began to happen is the bilge scale began to be torn away from the vessel. That's this protrusion at the very corner of the vessel, and that's there to dampen the roll motion. It's called a bilge keel. So as the vessel slid along the pinnacle, and this is what we're surmising based totally on the diver's video and the damage pattern. As the vessel slid along that pinnacle on the starboard side, it began to tear off that bilge keel, and that gave us the three ruptures along the starboard side. Essentially, each one is about 3 feet in length. That is a totally separate damage pattern that runs down the center tank section, and that is a very familiar pattern in the grounding, in which you see first the forward part of the vessel hits the pinnacle, and then you begin to get a series of openings in the hull, and that's those five crosshatched areas, and then the vessel came to rest in exactly the position it's now in, sitting on top of this pinnacle. That's a very different pattern, and we know clearly that that had to occur while the vessel was on a heading of about 270 or due west. And there's no, the reason we say there had to be two events is that there's no way to explain the damage on the starboard side if you look at where the vessel is resting right now. In fact, in the area of the starboard side, there's 60 or more feet of water. I mean, there's nothing there that would have caused that damage. So that damage, in our speculation or attempt to reconstruct the events, had to have occurred at some point prior to that.
More after the first impact?
Oh, I imagine it must have been.
So you're saying that it ran aground twice?
No, I'm saying it contacted twice. I'm making a technical distinction. It had to have hit something. Obviously a pinnacle.
I have a marine chart here, and looking at the chart in the vicinity that you're talking about, given the vessel's draft, I see no soundings that could account for that. Do you feel that perhaps this is an unsounded pinnacle that it hit?
We haven't really done our analysis that thoroughly. To tell you the truth, and let me just emphasize this, we are totally, totally committed to our two major objectives. Reconstructing what happened is our last priority. We are going to get to it. The Coast Guard is going to get to it. The NTSB is going to get to it. But we aren't wasting a single moment worrying about it right now, because that the answer to that will be no different 3 days from now than it is today. What we are addressing ourselves in absolute single-mindedness is the million barrels on the ship, salvaging the ship, and addressing the oil that's on the water. And we have 100 people just going dead out to that task. We will get back to further analysis of this, but we aren't going to waste any more of today's time or tomorrow's time or the day after. We are just overwhelmed with our initial objectives.
I must admit that I'm a little confused, and perhaps some other news people are too. We've heard from Mr. McCall of the Coast Guard and from your people, Mr. Siglione and Mr. Parrish, that you're doing an exemplary job in the oil cleanup, and yet just less than 2 hours ago, I had a long interview with the mayor on tape, with Mayor John Devens of Valdez, who overflew the operations late today for 2 hours. And his conclusion was that Exxon is doing very little of substance in terms of cleanup, and he was totally surprised at the absence of any visible cleanup activity.
And a very easy explanation. Mechanical cleanup is extremely slow. There is no way that we will clean up the oil that's on the water using mechanical cleanup. As of 6 p.m. tonight, we had recovered 3,000 barrels. 3,000 barrels. There is no way we will handle this spill with all the skimmers in the world. And we need to say that right out openly. We must have at our disposal all the tools possible to address that oil spill. We are very encouraged, and the mood of my response team is up, because starting tomorrow, we're going to begin to employ all three tools in very careful and very controlled areas. But where dispersants are the right answer, and that's in the Zone 1 area, we will use dispersants. Where burning is the right answer, we will use burning. And where mechanical pickup is the right answer, we will use mechanical pickup. So starting tomorrow, we will be using all three tools. Up to this point, we have been limited to one tool. It is the slowest and least effective. And I clearly could tell you that 3,000 barrels will be here this time next year, trying to get at it. That's why it was so important to get the state's permission to use burn, and so important to get the permission of all the authorities to begin to use dispersant in a very carefully controlled area.
Did you receive that?
Yes.
Did your contingency plan...
Tomorrow we're going to
Did your contingency plan call for it to be this slow, or did you anticipate it would be this sort of cumbersome process?
The state's contingency plan, as I understand it, for a 200,000 barrel spill, talks about immediately addressing the question of dispersants. We are very upbeat at this time because starting tomorrow, we're going to have three tools at our disposal rather than mechanical. Of the three tools, mechanical is the least effective. It has a very distinct purpose, particularly in the areas where you don't want to use burning or you don't want to use dispersants. So we must employ all three. In fact, there's four. The fourth one is the booming off of especially sensitive areas. So by tomorrow, we're going to be going all out, using all the tools at our disposal. And I'll tell you, my group is just way up because they feel, at least now, they will be addressing this spill with all of the things they have available. We have been so frustrated today, just as frustrated as Mayor Divens and everyone else, at the pace of recovery. And the reason for that frustration is because we have been limited to mechanical pickup. It's not going to do the job. There's no way I could stand up here and say it will.
You're incapable of using skimmers just because it took so long to, because you're incapable of using booms around the, or you're so slow in placing booms around the spill in the first place?
We